Hi, my name's Pete Knapp, an air quality PhD student at Imperial College London. This series of podcasts is kindly promoted by the Grantham Institute, the college's hub for climate change and environment. Subscribe to receive future episodes and contact the Grantham Institute on Twitter with @Grantham_IC and me with @PeteK_AQ. This is Tipping Points, a podcast featuring interviews with people who've become environmental activists. What made them change? What are they doing now? And what do they hope to see in the future as we face possible breakdown of civilization and life on Earth? This first series focuses on scientists in the UK. With me in this episode is Dr. Abby Perrin from York. Welcome.
Hello, Pete.
I say York, but you're in London for the first week of the rebellion. And when I say rebellion, I mean the two-week period of Extinction Rebellion protests in London in August 2021 with the big pink table and so on. Have you been able to sum up how you feel about your involvement in what happened in London?
I guess it's a constantly evolving thing how I feel about the week in London. I was quite apprehensive about going, not knowing what we would find when we got there, and having not been in London for a while. On the first day of the rebellion, I felt really disheartened because it felt like there weren't many people gathering in Trafalgar Square. But as the week went on, I had a lot of wonderful conversations with people. My intention for the week really was to be able to be out in the streets talking about science with lots of members of the public. But that really didn't materialise because of the way the protests were policed. So most of my conversations actually ended up being with people who were already part of the protest within police kettles around the protests. So it did turn out quite differently from how I imagined, but I still think those interactions with other protesters were really valuable. We gave loads of interviews to press and to individuals who had their own social media presences. And so I do think it was an effective way of getting some messages out there.
Were you happy kind of putting yourself in these police kettles?
It's an incredibly uncomfortable thing. And even though it's not the first time I've been in those situations, it's still a very overwhelming, a very intense and a very emotional experience. For me, there's a few things that go in my head in those situations. Firstly, how did it get to this point that I felt like I've needed to put myself in that position, you know, surrounded by thousands of police officers, just to try to get a scientific and a human message out there that our governments and institutions really need to change and support us all in a transition to a livable future. And also just the atmosphere can be quite difficult to manage, like the amount of noise, trying to work out where all your meals are coming from, looking after other people, bathroom visits. It's a strange experience, but alongside the kind of tension of the atmosphere, there's also a huge amount of positivity. It's always great to be part of groups of people who are coming together for a shared purpose, who just really want to make a difference in a positive way.
Do you think you could go over what led you to this point now?
I've been interested in science for as long as I can remember, although at school I particularly hated biology, which I now find quite funny. I went to university regardless and did a broad science degree and ended up specialising in microbiology because basically the invisible life around us is incredible. There are microbes out there that we need to keep us alive, and then there's other microbes that kill us, as we all know. And that led me to work on malaria for about 10 years. It's a really incredible parasite that can infect red blood cells and go virtually undetected by the immune system, which is why it causes so much disease and devastation all around the world. And it was an amazing time to work as a malaria researcher because we were seeing such transformative advances in our understanding because of this really concentrated research effort. And a few years ago, when I was deciding what I was going to do with my next job, I kind of thought, what can I really do in malaria? Wouldn't it be better to transfer the kind of skills and knowledge that that field has really capitalized on in the past 10 years and transfer them to a different field that hasn't had that and really needs it? The field that I hit on was a field of microalgae. They're basically, we can think of them as single-celled plants, and they do about half the world's carbon fixation. They're actually more efficient at carbon capture than plants are because they have an amazing ability to concentrate carbon dioxide. And we can also potentially use them in lots of much greener industrial processes, making foods and fuels. But all of that technology is really in its infancy because we just don't have that understanding at a really basic molecular biological level about how they operate. So I've joined that area of science now to try to understand these amazing creatures in more detail.
Was there anything that really hit you that made you think, I've got to change what I'm doing?
There are a few factors involved in the decision to change from the malaria field to the algae field. And the climate was a big part of that. Around the same time that I was thinking about what direction I wanted to take my own scientific career in, I had the quite shocking realization that despite years of me just assuming all the problems I knew about as a child with us wrecking our ecosystems and relying on fossil fuels, I had naively assumed that those problems had been sorted by the world's scientists and leaders. And a few years ago was when I really came to the conclusion that the situation hadn't got better, it had got worse. And that meant that we really had to reevaluate everything that we were doing. And it was a very confusing time in many ways, because whilst I was really enjoying the work I was doing, I was also looking at the bigger picture, even just within the malaria field. So my colleagues who work on mosquitoes rather than the parasites themselves were telling me that in the field, as soon as global temperatures increase, mosquito biting behavior is going to change in a way that profoundly will affect transmission of malaria. And that really wasn't something that was recognized in the community of people who were working on the parasites biology, whereas actually that's one of the major things that's going to affect the disease.
To focus again back on the rebellion, what was your experience of wearing a lab coat when you were out and about?
This is incredibly nerdy, but I did do an experiment of sorts. I spent the mornings not wearing my lab coat and then the afternoons wearing my lab coat. It was noticeable how many more people voluntarily came to speak to me when I was wearing a lab coat. Maybe a good conversation starter for people who do want to talk about their fears about the climate, but don't really feel like they have an in or have a way of asking someone. Whereas people saying, oh, you're a scientist, what do you think about this, was somehow easier for people than approaching a random stranger in the middle of a protest. There were doctors in scrubs and us in our lab coats. Sometimes, particularly members of my family, point out that the media portray protesters a lot as a specific type of person. And by having people there representing scientists and doctors and other professionals, helps bring us away from those unhelpful stereotypes about who's protesting. It's really difficult to measure the effect of individual actions or even like large-scale protests. And to me, that's quite frustrating because sometimes people will say, oh, I agree with the cause, but I don't agree with your methods. And it would be really brilliant to have some killer metrics to say, oh, look, this works. And we do have some evidence. We can see that like polling data suggests that people's degree of concern about the environment has risen when there have been large-scale disruptive protests from Extinction Rebellion. And we also see, you know, more coverage in newspapers with time. But it is really hard scientifically to nail down whether an individual action has a particular impact. And I guess with time, we will find better methods to be able to do this and to be able to assess the impact of what we're doing and to adapt and find out what works and find out what doesn't.
Do you think that being arrested works?
I've had a lot of discussions with myself about it. I think being arrested for a cause is a powerful statement. If you're able to say, I believe in this thing that I'm here talking about, I'm holding my ground to talk about, I believe in this thing enough that I'm willing to risk my personal freedom and the consequences of not just what happens to you when you get arrested and all the consequences that follow. It's also about what people might say to you and what people might think of you. And as for the effect of it on a larger scale, so one scientist being arrested going to change public opinion. For my sins, I read the comments sometimes on tweets or newspaper articles about protesters being arrested. And it's really difficult to know whether that's made someone someone stop and think, why would this person do this or not?
Let's say if you were to be arrested, how would you explain it to your parents?
I've tried to have some quite difficult conversations, not just my parents, but other important people in my life. I think it will take quite a bit of time before people do fully understand why I would do this or why I care about it so much. People I know are coming around to the idea that doing these sorts of things is not a sign of illness, it's a sign of commitment and concern.
When people decide that they want to become activists, there's a sense of loss and a sense of gain. That may not happen for everyone, right? So there might be some groups of people who do lose more than they'll gain. And I struggle with this because, I mean, in Extinction Rebellion, we talk about system change. And that will come with its costs as well as its benefits, right? We all know the benefits. But how do you feel about the costs of changing the system?
I think there inevitably will be costs in changing the system, but we have a lot of choice about what those costs are. And it is really one of the most pervasive tactics delaying action on climate is to talk about how this will hit people's lifestyles very hard. But we'd make a really, really great start if we hit certain really, really destructive aspects of lifestyle first and very, very soon. We're just talking about carbon emissions, for example. The richest 1% of the world's population produce more carbon emissions than the poorest 50% of the world's population. So actually, if we got those very wealthy people to make significant changes to their lives, which could be some quite simple things, a lot of wealthy people's carbon footprint is about 50% from flying. So if those people were to change one thing, that could be the first step of something really positive. I'd rather not get on an aeroplane than watch the world disintegrating. It sounds silly when you put it like that, but it would be different if I, for example, had family living in another continent. But for me, the enjoyment of a transatlantic adventure has lost its appeal. Now I know the effects. I can only really talk on a personal level, but I've made a lot of changes to my life. I basically cycle everywhere, transitioned almost to a plant-based diet. But those changes have not been easy. They've come with quite a lot of inconvenience and a small amount of sacrifice. Given how difficult it's been for me to do that in an environment that's quite conducive to doing it, then we need the support of the system. We need the system to make it easier to get around without a car. We need the systems to make it easier to buy our food without loads of packaging. We need lots of changes that support individuals to make better choices before we expect individuals to just off their own back face a massive uphill struggle to change their lives.
If someone's in ASDA, a system change is that they can pick anything they want and they'll be making an ethical choice. Whereas individual choice is about looking at the ingredients of every single item and making decisions based on your own individual research on everything.
I'm laughing because I feel your pain. I heard an interesting argument from a friend recently who watched me kind of agonizing about my decisions on what to choose on a menu. And he was like, you're going to put everyone off from making these changes in your life if it looks like you're making difficult decisions and making a sacrifice. I'm lucky enough to live somewhere in walking distance from a shop where I can just bring my own containers and refill them with whatever we need, like dry goods, in exactly the right quantities of what we need. And I love going there so much that it's genuinely the highlight of my week, which might be really sad, but it has enthused other people about it when they can see how happy I am to have my packaging free raisins or whatever.
I wanted to ask, when you finished in London, you finished a week before the end of it, so you had a kind of the first week in the rebellion, and there was that kind of euphoria, there was that community, there were all these things you were talking about, and then you had to go back to York for the second week. How did you feel about going from such drastically different environments straight after each other?
It was even more acute than that, because I went straight from the rebellion to a wedding. Switching my brain from thinking exclusively about the climate and ecological emergency and what we could do about it, and worrying about my friends who had been having all the experiences that they were having in that space and basically having no sleep, to suddenly switch into party mode didn't really feel like a thing that part of my brain felt like it was something that I shouldn't do. I'd committed to that week at the rebellion, but the second week I made a decision for my mental health and also for the people in my life that I would need to take a step back and spend that time with them. But actually going from the rebellion to the wedding I did was actually a very nice thing, because it did remind me, it was wedding of one of my oldest friends, and I'd never seen him so happy. And there was so much love in that room. And that reminded me why we were out on the streets protesting, because there's so much that we have to protect. There are so many beautiful things about being alive, those interactions between people that just bring so much joy. I've got into a habit which probably annoys people. In fact, I did it with my mum just earlier today, where a few days after a difficult conversation, even if we're talking about something unrelated, deliberately unrelated, I will say, did you think about that thing that we talked about? And that might be very annoying, but it has led to some more productive interactions with people. Because I never want to leave things on a note where it feels like, well, where there's tension between people who I care about. But also, I don't really want to be misunderstood that, I'm trying to tell them off.
What kind of difficult conversations might you be having with friends?
Absolutely. The most difficult conversation I've had with a few friends at the moment are about decisions to start families. And I will absolutely never, ever tell one of my friends, don't have a child, because that is absolutely their choice and it's something that's incredibly important in people's lives. But what I really, really fear for my friends is that they will make an important decision like this and then a few years later realize the things that I know now. And I can't imagine what that would feel like. I can't imagine starting a family on the premise that we're living in these amazing times and things are just gonna get better. And then that child's going to have this rich and exciting life, to then realize that the systems that are supporting our lifestyles are completely broken. They really need to change. And if they don't, then there will be devastating consequences. My worst fear is that someone I love will have that realization after they've made a choice that they wouldn't have made had they had that knowledge. And if they do decide to have a family, I will always be there for their little people who are growing up in this scary, scary world.
Have you come to a conclusion about starting your own family or not?
I'm at this point in my life where a lot of people do ask those kind of things. I don't think that's a decision that I would be able to make. I love all my little cousins. And if I become an aunt in some way, I'll be a great aunt. I'll be the fun aunt. But I don't feel like I could make that decision because of the level of fear I have about the future.
How about opinions on adoption? Do you think that might be something that either you personally would consider or that other people in a situation who are thinking about adding people to the world, but then having lots of people out there who need parents?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a winning combination that there are so many children out there who don't have loving homes and so many people who, when you're thinking about these really difficult decisions about whether to have children, whether those children need to be your own children.
Are the big decisions pension or getting a mortgage? These are the big decisions that people in their 30s are going to be thinking about. So what's your opinion on having a pension?
Been thinking about this a lot, and I've been talking to the university I work for about potentially withdrawing from our pension scheme if I want to believe that there is a future where I reach retirement. I would want to have a pension, but then you think, oh well, my chances of reaching that point are even just from a purely selfish level are increased if I don't give my money to these people who are wrecking the planet. So right now, it seems like for me, the best option would be to not contribute to that.
Winding back a little bit, you said when you were at school, you didn't really enjoy biology. So what was your focus then? What were you thinking about, when I'm older, I want to do this?
I particularly loved maths. But in school, I think it was taught in quite an uninspiring way. I certainly never learned about microalgae. Maybe that would be my biggest suggestion, about changing the syllabus so that everyone gets to see a photosynthetic microbe down the microscope. Who wouldn't join the field if we had that?
Cool. And so if you were to speak with your 15-year-old self now, what kind of word of advice would you be giving her?
It's a really interesting question, because my 15-year-old self didn't know about the crises that I worry about on a day-to-day basis now. But my 15-year-old self was much more miserable and much less positive, which I think is quite interesting. I basically would, if I could go back, I'd tell myself that there is a lot to be grateful for, a lot to celebrate, and to really think about what the most important things in life are. I think the things that give me the most joy in life are talking to different people, finding out about all their different experiences, and enjoying being around people and enjoying being around nature. 15-year-old me would ignore a ladybird. Now I see a ladybird and I'm like, how many spots has it got? Let's make sure it doesn't get mown down by this lawnmower. Maybe it's one of the invasive species that we don't like, but I still don't want it to die. So the things that I just ignored as a teenager, I take a lot of joy in now, and my life is happier for it.
That's really cool. Are there hobbies that you had that you still have, maybe, that might conflict with the crises?
Some friends would say my hobby is activism, whereas I'm trying to fight them on that and say, this is not a hobby. Mm. I feel like this is part of my job. Because ultimately, I think the message that we're trying to get out there is that some scientists have done some science. We really need to take science seriously.
Do you think activism has become an obsession?
So my instinct is to say no. I think I have found it difficult to set boundaries for myself that are healthy, coming up to any kind of action, not very able to focus on even my job. So it's really important to find a balance. I've not hit upon that sweet spot yet. It's also really difficult to switch off from it when you see so many things around you that trigger those alarm bells that something needs to change.
Really broad question for you. Why don't people rebel?
I've never thought of myself as the most likely person to rebel. So it's interesting that you ask that question. I mean, I've generally always kind of followed the rules. I guess I'm trying to think what made me change. I guess it was realizing that the rules were rubbish, that the game was broken. You know, the people who have the job of protecting us aren't protecting us. You know, I instinctively always trusted the police, but I've seen and heard things, and now I'm really not sure whether everything the police does actually functions to protect people. You hear people chanting at protests sometimes at the police, who do you protect? I think the main focus of my anger, basically, about people not playing by the rules is really directed at world leaders and people who present the image that they know better. Maybe they do know better, but perhaps they've chosen not to do better.
Yeah, I wonder, like, the people who follow the rules, let's say if you got a student at school who doesn't follow the rules, typically they wouldn't be excelling in maths and science. When you learn about maths and science as a school kid, they're about following rules, about applying an algorithm, about getting 100% in the tests, right? Whereas in drama and art or those kinds of music, breaking the rules is rewarded. Now, I wonder if that means that the scientific community find it much more difficult to rebel than, say, a community of artists or musicians. In your experience, why don't scientists rebel?
This is the million-dollar question for me, really. Oh, until last week, I've never successfully recruited another scientist to join a protest. But last week, a friend did join one of our actions and I could have cried. I think I did cry. I was very open about my involvement in activism in my previous job. I left our little Scientists for Extinction Rebellion business cards all around the Institute. I posted on all of our media channels about, you know, the sustainability chats. I'm going to this protest. If someone wants to come with me, then great. The biggest barrier for me joining activist movements was taking that brave step on my own. And if I'd have done it with someone else, that would probably have made it a lot easier for me. The first time that I was at a protest and came back very bedraggled and upset from it, my colleagues thanked me for doing what I was doing, but I haven't seen any of them involve themselves in activism in any way.
So if you were to use this platform now to speak with scientists who are thinking about joining XR, what would you say?
Firstly, talk to me. I will be completely honest about the pros and the cons. Being involved in activism absolutely doesn't mean you have to risk getting arrested. There are many completely legal ways that you can get involved.
Well, how would they contact you?
You can usually find me on Twitter.
Another question then about therapy. I've spoken to a lot of people so far in this podcast, and it seems quite common that we have this kind of barrier that therapy's only for crazy people, or that it's something that's like a last resort if you can't fix yourself. I know I personally felt that way about it, and I had this kind of obstacle about calling someone up and saying, hey, look, can I have a chat? Have you had any experience with therapy?
Yeah, quite recently, and it's been an overwhelmingly positive experience for me. The reason I did this is because I kept suggesting other people did it. I can see that there's such a good value in taking time out just to actually be really honest with yourself and say things that you might not say aloud to someone who's part of your close network. Sometimes when you say things out loud, you can tell how much sense they make, because in your head they make complete sense, but then when you say them to another person, you think, wait, this isn't as logical as I thought it was. The other thing that I would suggest, if people that don't think a formal counselling relationship is right for them, is that there are lots of peer support networks within activist circles, but also within other organisations, including workplaces.
When you're at work and you're doing these kinds of things, do you ever get the feeling as though you're working on something that at that moment you don't see the value in, but you have to kind of step back and say, actually, what is the big picture here?
All the time. Sometimes when things weren't working, particularly during my PhD, I can count on one hand the number of experiments that worked. And I thought, you know, what a waste of my time, everyone else's time, all this money, all of these resources. But then I kind of had to tell myself, and someone has to do all the garbage that doesn't help. Maybe you've just been a hero here and you've saved someone from suffering with this bit of science that isn't going to work.
Did you write much about that in your thesis, about what didn't work?
Oh, I really wanted to call my thesis something dramatic, like 4 years of pain. but I resisted.
But you got your PhD out of it.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess that's the good thing about PhD. And I would try and impart this knowledge to students. It's sad, but true. And it's the thing that adults say, which always disgusts me. You know, you learn a lot by failure. It doesn't necessarily have to be your personal failure, but like experiencing disappointment.
And with that, Dr. Abby Perrin, thank you very much. Cool. How do you feel about that? Are you happy?
Yeah, fine. It was nice having a chat, really. I kind of forgot that you were recording anything.
Oh, that's great.
Music from Climate by Eric Ian Walker. Commissioned by the Climate Music Project, we communicate the sense of urgency of the climate and ecological crises through the emotional power of music. More to be found at ericianwalker.bandcamp.com and climatemusic.org.